I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. While the prison population has steadily declined nationwide, Kansas has seen an increase over the past decade. The Kansas prison system has also been plagued with understaffing and high turnover rates. Today, Kansas lawmakers discuss the growing crisis. We'll find out what steps are being taken to lower the prison population and why officials are hesitant to approve some multi-million dollar changes proposed by Governor Laura Kelly. Then, a helium shortage. It affects so much more than you might expect. We'll learn the far-reaching consequences of losing this natural resource that's used for more than just party balloons. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Kansas prisons are a big fat mess. That's what some lawmakers think, and it's not hard to understand why. The prisons are overcrowded, and that's not going away anytime soon. In 2017, they were beset by riots. The turnover of guards has been sky high, and lawmakers themselves admit they've been slow to understand the crisis. While the country seems to be moving away from locking up so many people, Kansas seems to be walking down that same road. Lots to talk about here. Joining us are Kansas State Senator Pat Petty. She's a Kansas City, Kansas Democrat and a member of the Senate Corrections Subcommittee on the Ways and Means Committee. Senator, nice to have you back again. Welcome.
Thank you.
Kansas Representative John Resman is an Olathe Republican. He's a member of the Joint Committee on Corrections and Juvenile Justice Oversight. Representative, nice to have you.
How are you?
Our next guest is also a member of that committee. That's State Representative Boog Heiberger. He's a Lawrence Democrat. Representative, good morning to you.
Thanks, Steve. It's good to be here.
Senator Petty, is the state prison system a mess?
Yes, the state prison system is a mess. We have
overcrowded.
We have by the end of the year, we'll be beyond our capacity by the end of the fiscal year. We have an employment problem. We're not competitive. And
with hiring guards and keeping guards in place for a while. Yeah.
Yes. And it's statewide. It's not just in one area. It's throughout. And we have a safety and security issue for those guards that work and or any of the employees that work within the correction system. So, yes, we have a lot to face.
Representative Resman, do you agree with that?
Yes, I do. Yes.
Yeah. What do you think? What's the path forward here?
Well, I think that we're now beginning to realize what's going on. I think for a while we were kind of in the dark of what was happening, and I think it came to a forefront when we had the riots in 17. That really showed the desperate need for our Department of Corrections.
You know, help me with that a little bit, because back in 2014, now 5 years ago, the State Employees Union told lawmakers in no uncertain terms that staffing shortages in the prison had placed them at risk. Why was there no response to that?
I couldn't answer that question. I wasn't there in 14.
Yeah.
So I think
was set a long time ago.
Right. It probably goes back even further than that of shortages, lack of pay, benefits. Now that's coming to the forefront, and I think we're addressing some of those issues.
Yeah. Representative Heiberger, to what extent do you think the prison system remains at risk today, even in terms of future unrest and maybe even riots?
I think there's a serious degree of risk. I think we did take some steps during the last legislative session at Governor Kelly's initiative to provide some additional funding that I think will help correct some of the problems, but we have a long way left to go.
You know, Governor Kelly wanted a lot more money, I guess, in relative terms. The legislature didn't give her all that money. In fact, just maybe a half of that or so.
No, my understanding is that most of the money was there, but a lot of it was, instead of being allocated by the legislature, the disbursement of that was left to the Finance Council, and that they withheld some of that.
Okay, so it's the Finance Council. That's a committee of state lawmakers that has some control over the spending of the budget, and they're holding money back.
Right. I mean, in the original budget that I think we had a majority support for, that money was left at the discretion of the department. But after the failed attempt to not enact a budget to get the Senate to enact Medicaid, vote on Medicaid expansion, the budget we ended up with was worse in the corrections department.
Yeah. Senator Petty, do you have any insight into this, the dollars that have been allocated for the prisons? I saw you going through papers, and I was wondering if you were looking at some numbers there.
Well, I think one of the issues that occurred was the fact that the legislature, and I believe the governor, Kelly as well, felt that it's an overall problem and shouldn't just be looking at El Dorado. And so, but in the final budget, some funding salary funding was appropriated just to El Dorado. And then the LCC did come in and raise that, add $9 million more for salaries after
system-wide.
System-wide.
So you're saying Governor Kelly's focus was on El Dorado, one of our state prisons?
No. Governor Kelly wanted to see money go system-wide.
I see.
That was made by the legislature to go directly to El Dorado. And I think there was we received information from the Department of Corrections that was not the best way to go, that it should be overall, that we should be looking at the whole system and not mm-hmm. just one area, one prison in our system. So I think now we're moving. We still are way behind, but at least that money was then appropriated shortly after the session ended.
You know, revenues are up higher than expected, Representative Resman. Again, given the recent history of the system with rioting and that kind of thing, why aren't more alarm bells ringing among lawmakers to deal with this more aggressively?
Well, it's kind of like I stated earlier, is that I think a lot of it was hidden from us from previous directors. Mm-hmm. One of the committees I'm on is the Corrections Committee, and the first time we were briefed, they made it sound like the riots weren't that bad and that they had the problem under control. But then when
we found out later, they were a lot worse than that.
Correct. Right. The interim secretary kind of spoke plain English to us and brought pictures and told us exactly what was going on. And the pictures are worth 1,000 words. And when you see some of the damage that was done and the assault on some of the staff, it really hits home about what's going on inside our prisons.
This was the interim secretary who was put in place after Governor Kelly won the election and took over the administration, right?
Yes, that's correct.
How do you feel as a lawmaker when you're not getting the straight poop from the gubernatorial administration, in this case of Governor Sam Brownback?
It kind of sets you back a little bit because you really do want to do the right thing. And if you don't have the information, it's kind of hard to allocate proper funds to ensure that we don't have these type of problems.
Representative Heiberger, how do you feel about that when straight information wasn't coming to you as a lawmaker?
Well, I think it's infuriating. I feel betrayed, and I think we ended up making decisions that injured people. And so I'm really frustrated by that situation.
You know, Senator Petty, I think everyone agrees the prison system is over capacity, understaffed, underfunded. I'm still wondering, how did it get this way? What happened?
Well, I think part of the picture that's just been painted is the fact that the legislature was provided information that made it sound it's okay, we're moving ahead, it's not as big a problem as it appears. In fact, I was on the oversight committee last year, and we visited El Dorado in the summer, and it was like, oh yeah, we've recovered, there's not as many issues, and we're moving ahead, when in reality, if you don't have the staff, if you don't have the security guards there, if you're overpopulated, you're not going to be able to meet their needs. So it's not just guards, it's providing resources as well, whether it's mental health or whether it's education, job training. Those officers also are very overloaded and unable to provide the services.
We're talking about officers, security guards who are working 18, even 20-hour shifts, I'm told, days in a row. That's because we've been so chronically understaffed for so long.
Well, we still have facilities where it's mandated 12-hour shifts at all times. So
everyone's working 12-hour shifts now, and it goes beyond that sometimes. You know, yes. Representative Resman, one thing else I wanted to clear up here, the Brownback administration cut taxes dramatically. To what extent did those tax cuts undermine funding for prisons going forward?
It probably had a dramatic effect since they were cutting from every agency. And prisons, I think, are probably pretty much overlooked a good part of the time because, they're set in rural areas. Most people don't know they even exist until they have to come in contact with them. So mm-hmm. I think they're kind of the forgotten service.
Does that make sense to you, Representative Heiberger?
To some extent, I think they're not on everybody's radar, but I mean, I think the budget cuts from the Brownback administration were across the board. I'm not sure the corrections department suffered worse than other state agencies, frankly.
You know, Governor Kelly, for what it's worth, places the blame squarely on the shoulders of her predecessor and his tax cuts. She said of Governor Brownback, "We have an emergency in Kansas because of prior years of bad decision-making that crippled our corrections operations." Is that a fair appraisal, Senator?
Oh, I think absolutely. It just shows that corrections, like so many other departments, they can't recover overnight. They can't recover in 1 year. And what's been happening year after year is going to take a long time to repair. And this is a system that you have people that are incarcerated and the numbers are growing. And as that numbers are growing, if you don't have the services to provide for them, if you haven't been paying for those, if you haven't been building up the staff and looking at the whole system of corrections reform, mm-hmm. then you're going to have more and more people in prison, and you're going to not just only enter prisons, but also when they're outside, and then they have oversight as well. Those people are also understaffed.
We're talking about the woeful state of Kansas prisons. If you have a question for our good panel here, our number 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Representative Resmond, Senator Petty just said that the numbers in terms of inmates in the Kansas prison system is increasing. Other states are going in exactly the opposite direction. Why are we increasing numbers of prisoners in Kansas when the national trend appears to be just the opposite?
I think it's probably some of the programs that other states have instituted prior to people being incarcerated, which I think we're now seeing some of the effects that hopefully we can bring on board that will help do that for first-time offenders.
And nonviolent offenders?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. And the legislature has taken some steps in that direction, hasn't it?
Yes, we've gotten several reports from the Sentencing Commission, and I think in our committee we've heard testimony about some programs that they want to bring on board to help people prior to being incarcerated.
Representative Heiberger, has the legislature been aggressive enough when it comes to trying to decrease the number of inmates in the system to perhaps avoid having to build another
sure.
prison?
Well, when I first joined the Corrections Committee, I was afraid it was just going to be bill after bill raising sentences on crimes. And I was pleasantly surprised to find out otherwise, because any time that our prison system is over capacity, the Kansas Sentencing Commission is required to bring us ideas for reducing our prison population. And that's been the case every year since I've been there. So we've been making incremental changes over the last 5 years. And so that I think our prison population is growing. It's kind of plateaued, though, because of these incremental changes that we're making each year. But DOC projections now say if we don't make any changes, we're looking at an increase of 2,000 inmates over the next 10 years.
And that would require another prison.
Yes, and I think that would be a gross misuse of Kansas taxpayer dollars. I think we can find ways to not have to do that.
Because the cost of building that prison would be tens of millions of dollars.
I've heard an estimate of $135 million just for constructing a 1,000-bed prison. So a 2,000-bed prison were in way over $200 million. But the operating costs for a 2,000-bed facility would be in the minimum $50 million, more like $60 million range.
So the legislature has some work to do along these lines.
If we want to avoid spending that money on a prison, we do. But you know, I just imagine what we could do if we took that kind of money and applied it towards services. I think we already have a lower state prison incarceration rate than national average. But I just imagine what
that's the case. Why are we? We're still over capacity. At least that's the last set of numbers I saw.
We are. But I mean, if you look at just incarceration rates per 100,000, Kansas is at 331, I think. National average is 450. Missouri's at 573. Mm-hmm. Oklahoma's 673, I think. So and we're doing some things right, but we could do a lot better, I think.
So if that's the case, why are we over capacity?
Population's growing and more people are being convicted of more crimes, and people are getting longer sentences for crimes. I think that's part of it. Well, actually, I want to step back. Over half of our admissions in fiscal year 18 were for technical probation violations. So the people who served their sentence are on probation are coming back because they, you know,
didn't report to their probation
or tested positive for alcohol. And so if we could take 20% of our technical probation violators and not have them go back to prison, that would save over 1,000 admissions a year.
Well, why doesn't the legislature take care of that? Because other states have already gone in that direction.
Well, I think part of it is resources. I think if you're really going to work with probationers and parolees to keep them from getting back into the system, it takes services on the outside, and we haven't been willing to allocate those funds so far. Hmm. That's my perception.
Okay, 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Let's go to some calls. And Thomas from Kansas City, Missouri, good morning.
Yeah, hi, Steve. I was wanting to know how much of the Kansas prison system is privatized. That seems to be a growing problem in a lot of states with regard to quality of care provided to the inmates as far as mental health support.
Thomas, you're asking a great question, and I was going to go there in just a moment. KCUR just reported that the state is looking to turn to private contractors to handle the overflow from its overcrowded prisons. You know, to Thomas's point, how reliable are for-profit jails these days? You read terrible things. How expensive are they, Senator?
Well, we're also looking at contracting with our local jails as well. So, in the past, the issue has been they've stayed there too long and the state hasn't paid the jails. So that would be a better way to go to be paying our local jails if they have the over bed capacity.
But local jails don't really trust the state these days because bills were not paid.
Well, it has changed somewhat. But if they're going to stay there, they want to be paid for them. So if they're going to come back there, they want to be paid. If they're going to contract with our jails, then they're going to want to be paid.
So are private jails in the works here in the conversation or not?
I know they're in the conversation. I don't know enough to speak about it.
My understanding of the governor's proposal is that they want to temporarily shut down a wing of El Dorado and house about 1,000 prisoners somewhere else. There's not enough local county jail capacity. So they were possibly proposing doing some out-of-state housing in private prisons, but state private prisons are prohibited for the state in Kansas.
They're prohibited.
The state cannot operate a private prison, and under most circumstances, the local jurisdictions are prohibited. There's some exceptions to that, I think, and then there are private prisons, I believe, for federal inmates.
Well, the state can't operate a private prison. Can it send inmates to a private prison?
I don't know of any legal impediment to that, as long as it's out of state.
How would you feel about that?
I think it should be an absolute last ditch resort. I really think taking away someone's liberty is something that shouldn't be privatized. I think the people who are responsible for care of people who are incarcerated ought to be entrusted to people who are responsible to voters, not to shareholders.
But it sounds like private prisons are in the state's future, given the overcapacity issues that we're talking about here.
I haven't heard of any private prisons being used for housing of inmates. I've heard moving them out of state, which I think would be a mistake. But as far as privatization, I haven't heard anything about that.
Well, what choices does the state have if we're overloaded as much as we are?
Well, it's not going to be an overnight fix. We're going to have to probably temporarily put people in probably county jails and then try to work with some type of legislation to reduce the number of people that are going to prison. Mm-hmm. It won't be an overnight fix.
Yeah. Senator Petty, does that sound about right to you?
I would agree, because one of our biggest growing populations is just women. And there was a proposal made to repurpose a juvenile correction facility in Topeka actually open it up for those women, and that the LCC did not approve that, so that didn't occur. That would open up some beds, because that's a population that's is continuing to grow at a faster rate.
So where do we stand then with private prisons? So it sounds like that's not going to happen right away then. But in the meantime, you're looking at other options. Am I hearing that right?
I think we are. I mean, I think that as was mentioned, if they're going to be private, it's going to be out of state, but we're going to be looking at what we can do within our state right now.
Mm-hmm. What about the prospects for building the new prison that Boog just mentioned a few minutes ago? Again, new prison might cost $135, $145 million, depending on how big you want to make it. Is that in the offing here?
I haven't heard of any new prisons, but Lansing currently is under construction, and when it reopens, it should alleviate some of the overcrowding.
But not much. It's not going to allow for much more capacity.
Correct. That'll be temporary.
Mm-hmm. With Lansing being rebuilt, why wasn't there more thought given to adding more capacity there to ease some of these crowding concerns we have?
I think I could think it was probably a budget consideration.
Mm-hmm.
Or it could be space, too. I think they're still building within some of the walls of the old institution.
Yeah.
Well, that was sort of a legislative runaround. It was privately contracted out by the Department of Corrections. The idea, it was going to be funded by savings on staffing because it would be designed to lower the need for staffing. But given the information that we received otherwise from the Department of Corrections, I have serious concerns about whether that's accurate or not.
A lot of people do, right? There's a lot of skepticism about this notion that we're going to save a lot of money through staffing there.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So what are the changes you'd like to see in the next session or two to solve the big issues that ails these prisons, from understaffing to overcrowding? Senator Petty, let me begin with you. What needs to happen going forward?
Well, I think we absolutely have to look at the staffing problem. I mean, that's going to continue. It's not going to get better. And if there's not better pay and better benefits, then we are continuing to have a staffing issue.
But there is better pay, though, right? I'm just looking for my numbers here. But the state has raised pay from something like $13.61 an hour for starters up to $18.26 an hour. That's a significant jump. Doesn't that make us competitive?
It's a significant jump, but when you're so low that it looks like it's great, it's kind of like you can compare it to teachers. But also you have to look at who they're competing with. If they're competing with the federal prison, if they're competing with the local jails, if they're behind all of them, then we're still training and losing. And we have to be in a situation we're going to train and keep. Mm-hmm. And that has been a continual problem, no matter where you go in the state. And I think it's not going to go away if we don't address it.
So your point is, you don't just snap your fingers, raise the rate of pay, and the problem is solved. It's going to take some time to get there.
Absolutely.
Do you want to raise it beyond the $18.26 an hour to start?
Yes, because the recommendation last year was beyond the $18.20. I think it was $21 was the recommendation that came in from the Corrections Department, and we went for at the 18. So I think we have to look at a higher pay if we're going to keep them in our prison system and not train them to go someplace else.
In the meantime, do you remain concerned about the problems of uprisings in prisons?
Absolutely. If we have overcrowding and we have we're like 400 over 400 officers short, then we're going to continue to have that. So we not only have to look at pay, but we have to look at those services that are being provided that are going to help to prepare the inmates to move out, and education within our system, counseling within our system, so that we can address those needs that we aren't able to do now because of shortage of staff.
And right now we're already housing inmates two to a cell, so in many cases across the state, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Representative Resman, what do you want to see going forward here?
I'd like to see better pay and benefits for the officers to bring them up to their full complement. I think at that point, it'd probably ease a lot of tension between the inmates and the officers who are working a lot of hours right now. The first line for anything to happen would be the correctional officers. They're the ones at the first line of the defense. To ensure that things are running smoothly, and without proper training and proper motivation, we're going to be in the same boat we are next year at this time.
And you remain concerned about the possibility of uprisings as well?
Yes.
Okay. Boog, I'll come to you in just a moment here. Let's go back to some calls. And Richard from Kansas City, Kansas. Richard, you're on Up to Date.
Hi. I was looking online the other day, and Illinois is talking about releasing close to 770,000 inmates.
770,000, Richard? Are you sure about that?
I think so. That are in prison for nonviolent drug offenses.
That number is probably too high, but I hear your point, though. Yeah.
Because my question is, you know, what percentage are in for nonviolent offenses? And, you know, that would be quite helpful if we could say to these guys, okay, probation and drug rehab, or, you know, counseling or whatever,
right,
as opposed to teaching them how to be violent people by being in prison for 2, 5, 10 years, whatever it is.
Representative Booga Heiberger, do we know what percentage of our inmates are in for nonviolent offenses?
I don't, but I do know we've made some progress since I've been in the legislature about sending drug offenders to prison. We have a program called SB 123 that allows a judge to provide treatment rather than incarceration for most possession offenses. We extended that to some lower level distribution offenses last year. Funding, of course, is an issue for that. I don't think our primary problem in Kansas is massive numbers of nonviolent offenders in our prison system. I think it's
just overall numbers.
Yeah, we can make some progress there still, but I think we've already made some. It's my perception, and please correct me if I'm wrong.
Okay. Let me go back to some phone calls here, and Dennis from Overland Park. Dennis, you're on Up to Date. Good morning. We're talking about the Kansas prison system, which is in dire straits. Good morning.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I volunteer at the Lansing Prison. We have a Toastmasters Gavel Club in Maxim that we've had for 12 years, and I've been doing it for four. A year after being there, I realized they needed one in minimum. It's taken me 3 years to get the club started. I've got the club started in minimum, so we have one in max, and we have a club in minimum. And after getting the club started for 8 weeks, I had a guard look me in the face and say, oh, at the new minimum building, there will be no classrooms for the inmates. And after working on this for 3 years, I'm getting told that I may not have a place to have my Toastmasters club for my inmates. And the motto of our club is to find my voice will set me free. We are getting guys to talk about their lives and their goals, and it's changing their lives.
Okay, Dennis, I appreciate that. I'm wondering about the overall sentiment of what Dennis is saying in terms of giving inmates an opportunity for rehabilitation, continuing education. Representative Resman, what are you seeing along those lines?
I'm trying to think of an instance when somebody would say to someone that they didn't have the space or they weren't going to have the educational programs. I find that kind of hard to believe. It's one of our tasks in the prison system is part of rehabilitation.
Is rehabilitation happening in the prisons?
I think it's happening, but it's kind of difficult when you have the problems that we have, is overcrowding, some of the money that we're spending properly in the right places. So I think it's not being taken care of in the proper manner.
Yeah, Senator Petty, what do you think? Are prisoners being rehabilitated?
Well, I totally agree. There's over our staff has beyond their capacity of handling. We have an average of 80 inmates per staff member to work with them, whether it's for education, whether it's for counseling, and that's way overload. So, and then if you talk about paroling them, and then parole officers, they're also, the average should be at 40 to 45, and they're now have 60 clients to parole officers. So those are the kinds of positions, along with the guards, that we need to look at if we're going to be proactive, and also, as the gentleman just mentioned, work with inmates to be able to give them the voice so that they are ready to go back into society and have skills and feel confident that they're going to be welcome back.
How much interest is there in the legislature for exactly what you're talking about?
I think the legislature is becoming more interested. I do serve on the Juvenile Justice Oversight, which is a population that we haven't been talking about very much today. But one of the things that we're looking at with the funding that's from Senate Bill 367 is doing just that, being able to provide programs within communities. Communities, there's a grant program where they can apply for those, but also being very proactive. So not only working with the juvenile, but their families as well, and looking at the mental health. I think our legislature has become much more interested in brain development and early childhood, and understanding how this toxic stress is just the beginning and how it leads to other issues later in life, whether it's education problems or whether it's running into issues with the law enforcement, and that we can deter that if we look earlier on and make investments earlier on.
Representative Heiberger, I didn't ask you for your suggestions for the path forward in the next session or two for the legislature. What do you want to see happen when it comes to dealing with understaffing and overcrowding in the prisons?
Well, one thing the legislature did this session was to create a criminal justice reform commission, and I'm looking forward to seeing the recommendations that come out of that.
When will we see those?
I think the appointments are made by the 1st of August, and then they'll be and make some preliminary suggestions for recommendations for the 2020 session, and then beyond that. I think alluded to this earlier, but I think anything we can do to reduce the number of people returning to prison for technical probation violations, and that's probably the lowest hanging fruit.
Okay. I appreciate our good panel talking about the situation with Kansas prisons, Kansas Senator Pat Petty, Kansas Representative John Resman, and State Representative Boog Heiberger. Appreciate you all taking some time. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you. Thanks for being here.
When we come back, we're going to talk about helium and what it does beyond just being used for party balloons. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the show, we learned about some of the options women have for self-defense. For some, that includes a handgun. Hear that in other previous episodes at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, Kansas Governor Laura Kelly will be in the studio. We'll ask her about Medicaid expansion in the state, about Republican resistance, and about her relationship with lawmakers in the State House. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, Kansas is home to a series of private refineries that turn crude helium into helium that can be used for a whole host of things, like MRIs and vital science experiments and scuba tanks, and yes, to blow up all those balloons at a birthday party. Problem is, supplies of helium appear to be fading, and that's causing a lot of concern. After all, it only took a few hundred million years for the decay of radioactive elements deep inside the Earth to develop helium to begin with. Scientists, like our next guest, are worried about what the dwindling supply might mean. With us, William Halperin joins us via Skype from the campus of Northwestern University, where he's a physicist in the Department of Physics and Astronomy. William, nice to have you. Welcome.
I'm glad to be here.
Why should I, or anybody else for that matter, be concerned about this shortage of helium?
Well, there are broad uses for helium. You mentioned some of them. The uses here at Northwestern University are not so different from other institutions and national laboratories which require the coldest liquids that are known. Helium in a liquid form can reach close to the lowest temperatures that have ever been achieved and may be achieved in the future. So it has a special place in providing a medium for fantastic new science to be developed. And when it's not available, then there's going to be a shortchange of that process.
So, Professor, give me a broader sense of what helium winds up being used for beyond blowing up birthday balloons.
So, in particular, there are the gaseous forms of helium, which you've just mentioned, blow up a balloon, and actually the military used these balloons for surveillance and lifting. So consequently, the helium in a gas form has a diverse set of applications. But as I just mentioned, if you cool that gas down to very low temperatures, it becomes a liquid. And in fact, it becomes a liquid to the lowest temperatures that have ever been achieved. So in that very cold environment where quantum mechanics plays an important role, we invent new materials. We are able to study superconductivity. Superconductivity is the conduction of electricity with absolutely no resistance. So you need liquid helium in order to do that job. And this is the advances which are taking place in this field take place in universities such as Northwestern and in national labs and around the world.
And as you've just said, helium is used to cool off stuff. What's it used to cool off?
In particular, the new materials that we discover, those materials which find their way into your cell phone, those materials which are part of the digital age, they are discovered at these low temperatures and refined and made more pure and their physical properties. They're studied, such as in my laboratory here at Northwestern. These are the this is the process of basic science, which feeds into the technological infrastructure of the United States and the world.
Hmm. If we no longer had it, what would be the consequence?
Well, first, let me say, I think we're always going to have helium. At the present time, the shortage, it's really a balance between the manufacturing industries and other applications which are drawing off the limited supply. I would say that it's that balance which is causing the shortage. I think the helium, which is, as you mentioned, has been produced for over 100 million years. It takes that long to acquire helium from the radioactive elements. So we can't wait that long, of course. But it's been at work for a long, long time, and so the helium is buried in the earth, and it comes out in a steady stream.
But Do we know how much it is still buried in the earth?
No, we don't. We really don't have a good sense of that. We know that some of the areas, some of the countries of the world have more helium in their gas wells than others. But at the present time, helium is obtained by purifying natural gas, that is the fossil fuel that we burn for heat. It's a byproduct. Helium is really a byproduct of that industry. So you can imagine that if that industry changes, if the natural gas industry changes, then that will affect dramatically the helium industry.
Hmm. Are we sure, in fact, that there is a shortage of helium? Because I've read some accounts that suggest that's really overblown.
It depends upon how you define that term, shortage. If I define the term shortage, that the helium's not accessible, we can't buy it, it's not available to us. And that can be for a number of reasons. It does not necessarily mean that it has been depleted from the earth. It just means it's not in the marketplace.
And if it's not in the marketplace, does that suggest that the prices are too low or too high? What does that tell me?
Well, I think the marketplace is a dynamic. It's important to have infrastructure for extracting the helium from natural gas, and that makes it available to everybody.
Right.
But if there are very few providers, you know, there's only one airline, for example, serving an airport, then you're pretty much at the mercy of whatever the dynamics of the marketplace might be.
Yeah.
And that can lead to shortages and non-availability.
You know, I'm wondering how the skyrocketing cost of helium has affected your work there at Northwestern, because I've read that higher costs has caused some scientists to actually give up their pay for a time so their institutions can continue to afford supplies of helium for the experiments they want to do. Am I hearing that right?
Yes, I think you are. I don't personally know of such incidents, but I would say that the availability of helium is critical. Let me be clear. If an MRI does not have helium available, then it will warm up. And to cool the MRI back down to a temperature where it can operate, which requires helium, then there will be a big clinical impact.
Hmm.
The same is true in basic science. We need to maintain the temperatures uniformly sufficiently low that the work can be done. And if indeed the work can't be done and the helium is not available, then these magnets, in particular superconducting magnets, will warm up, and to get them back to where they were can be on the scale of many, many months, and that can be of critical importance.
If you're just joining us, so you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking about helium and concerns that supplies are dwindling and what that might mean for all of us here. We're visiting with William Halperin via Skype. He's a physicist at the Department of Physics and Astronomy at Northwestern University. In layman's terms, Professor, can you describe, you know, what helium is exactly?
Well, helium is one of the lightest elements in the universe. Hydrogen is the lightest. Helium, however, because it's so light and is chemically inert, it doesn't combine with other elements. Hydrogen forms a molecule that is very reactive. So helium has a special place. And the reason it's so special is because it's so light and chemically it's inert. That means that it can maintain in its liquid form at extremely low temperatures. You may have heard, for example, about levitated trains. Well, levitated trains depend on the existence of helium. So if you look at the future and you say, well, we're going to buzz around in these wonderful levitated trains at unbelievable speeds, that all depends on helium.
Well, help me understand how helium could levitate a train, because in preparing for this, I saw a video of a group of folks who blew up a series of really big balloons in an attempt to lift one man off the earth and allow him to fly. They had like 15 big balloons attached to his backside trying to lift him off the ground, and even that proved to be touch and go at best. So how would helium manage to raise an entire train filled with passengers?
Well, the Goodyear blimp, you know, it uses helium. So okay, it's pretty clear if you have a big enough balloon, it's going to work for you. But that's not how the levitated trains work. The levitated trains work on the basis of magnetism.
Ah.
And the helium, in its liquid form, not in the gaseous form that you find in the Goodyear blimp, but in its liquid form at low temperatures, can support the existence of superconductivity. These are super magnets.
Mm-hmm.
And those super magnets will repel partner magnets, which are on the ground. And that repelling force is what lifts the train. And that can be very powerful. Mm-hmm. If you go on the web, you can see pictures of sumo wrestlers, these really gigantic human beings,
right,
being lifted by a small table right off the ground, and that's from the magnetism. But the magnetism requires low temperatures.
But I want to be real clear about one point, Professor Halperin. You're saying, if I'm hearing you right, you're not concerned about the supplies getting so low that when I go to get an MRI, I'm going to be asking for trouble.
No, I think the MRI situation is probably such a large investment in the availability of helium that will be an industry that will survive.
Mm-hmm.
What's more critical is the development of new kinds of MRI, medical instrumentation, new quantum materials for the digital age. That takes place in the universities and in our labs, that are national laboratories. And that is where there is currently a very difficult problem because of the researchers not having access to helium.
Hmm. Where do we get helium? Where do you get it? At Northwestern?
Well, we buy helium, which comes today from the Federal Helium Reserve.
But that reserve is shutting down, right?
That's going to be a problem.
That reserve should be shut down by 2021, 2022, somewhere in there, right?
2021. It's scheduled for 2021. And there's a large group of those who see that if their access to the helium from the Federal Reserve is halted, then they will have really a very difficult problem going forward. And they're actively trying to discuss this with legislators who might be able to change the legislation which is slating that reserve to be closed.
I was going to say, if it's so vital, why is the Federal Reserve being shut down?
Well, basically the government back in 1996 decided with legislation that they really wanted to get out of the market. You know, they didn't want to play an immediate role in supplying a commercial market. And for that reason, they decided that the helium reserve, which was formed initially to store helium for military purposes, that it wasn't needed anymore.
What do you think of that?
Well, I can understand that point. However, a lot of the research that I had just mentioned is supported by taxpayers. Taxpayers who've already paid for that helium that was put into the reserve. And it would make sense to many of us that if the reserve is closed, at the very least, it should be held available, if not for the open market, it should be made available to the government. And basically, the taxpayers don't have to pay twice. So that's why I think with some legislative assistance, that it might be possible for the government use of helium, which most of the research I've mentioned is supported by, could go forward.
You know, my knowledge of science is pretty thin, but I'm thinking, if I understand right, Professor, helium is all around us, and I'm wondering why we couldn't recapture helium from the atmosphere to give us an endless supply going forward.
All right, the helium that's in the atmosphere is part of a steady state. The helium comes out of the ground. It just leaks out of the ground in dribs and drabs, and that goes into the atmosphere, just like the helium from the party balloon. And it disappears in about 2 weeks into outer space. So it's a dynamic. Mm-hmm. The helium that is in our atmosphere is representative of the amount of helium that leaks out of the ground. It's just not commercial to recover it from all the surface area of the Earth and from the oceans, for that matter. It has to be extracted from the natural gas because it's the only commercial way that we can get enough helium together in one spot that we can then package up, send it by FedEx or wherever, you know, to the user.
You know, we know about these vast fields of helium. There's one in Texas, for instance. Have other fields of helium with massive quantities been discovered, Professor?
Well, when you say massive quantities, keep in mind that the helium concentration in the natural gas that's taken out of a well is of the order of 1%. It's not really that large. And if the concentration drops down below 1%, then it becomes not commercial, meaning the cost escalates exponentially.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a boundary there. We don't have the technology to recover extremely small concentrations of helium.
But I've got 15 seconds left. Are there other fields of helium around the world?
Yes, there are. Sure. Helium is in Wyoming and Utah, and there are wells there. But importantly, new wells are being exploited in Qatar, in the Middle East.
Ah, okay. That's William Halperin joining us via Skype from Northwestern University. He's a physicist there. Professor, thanks so much for your time. Enjoy talking to you.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you. Yesterday in the show, we spoke with Jackson County officials and the county assessor about property assessment spikes and what can be done to ease the load on property owners. Hear that conversation and others at kcur.org/uptodate. You can find and follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. Tomorrow, we sit down with Kansas Governor Laura Kelly to discuss her first 6 months in office and her plans moving forward. Join us for that conversation tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Emily Aiken. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.